Hello, friends and colleagues, and welcome to episode 120 of Dermasphere, the podcast by dermatologists, for dermatologists, and for the dermatologically curious. I am one of your hosts. My name is Luke Johnson. I'm a pediatric dermatologist and general dermatologist with the University of Utah. And joining me, of course, is...
This is Michelle Tarbox. I'm an associate professor of dermatology and dermatopathology at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in beautiful sunny Lubbock, Texas. And we're recruiting, so if anyone wants to come practice in beautiful sunny Lubbock, Texas, please send me a message.
You'll also get to see the pimping bell in person. There she is now. So the pimping bell exists to highlight especially question-worthy content. So pay attention when the pimping bell sings. Our mission, of course, is to come to you every 2 weeks with discussions of some of the latest episodes. The latest research in the world of clinical dermatology. And it's the holiday season, and listeners, we've got a little present for you. That's right, Dr. Steve Feldman is back. Hooray! Yay! Thanks for joining us again, Dr. Feldman.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure for us, too. You have been on probably a half a dozen times or so now, but you're an audience favorite, so we'll have you on as often as you'll come on. For those of us who are, those of the audience who are unfortunate enough not to have heard you before, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm a professor of dermatology, pathology, and public health sciences here at Wake Forest University School of Medicine in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
Beautiful. And among many of your other talents, you have a book that is called An Illustrated Dictionary of Behavioral Economics for Healthcare Professionals. You wrote it with a colleague, Scott A. Davis. And I find behavioral economics fascinating. So I was excited to find this book some time ago, which talks about its utility in the world of medicine and also in dermatology in particular, I think, since you're a dermatologist who wrote the book. So we've been sort of marching through the chapters as kind of a roadmap as to what to talk about in terms of these concepts. Since it's been a little while, I want to just refresh everybody's memory. So the term behavioral economics, I feel the term is a little bit of a misnomer because it doesn't usually have all that much to do with economics. It's more like the science of how people make decisions. And stop me if you think I've got anything wrong, Dr. Feldman.
I would just say that is what economics is. Economics doesn't necessarily have to be solely about dollars.
Well, when I heard economics, I think about dollars. But I had to train myself not to think that way when it came to behavioral economics.
Yes, well, I think of economics as the physics of human behavior.
Ooh, I love it.
I like that.
And behavioral economics drills down into how people make decisions specifically. And one of the central tenets is that people are predictably irrational. So we are rational, but we're predictably irrational. And some of the science behind behavioral economics is how to predict how people are going to behave irrationally. So I wanted to move on to chapter 7 today, which is about mental accounting. Steve, do you want to tell us about mental accounting?
Yeah, so mental accounting, I think, is one of the chapters in this book that is least applicable to patient care. And yet it's the one I think about most often in my daily life. And I think it probably applies to the daily lives of dermatologists in a big way. So it refers to how we compartmentalize in our brains various economic decisions. For example, I get these grocery store coupons in the mail, and I feel bad if I don't use them. And it's like a 50-cent coupon here, maybe $5 off on $100. Whereas, you know, I'm spending buckets of money on other stuff and not worrying about those little tiny differences. But because I seem to have a grocery store coupon account in my head, I feel like I gotta optimize that account. Totally out of proportion to what it really should be in my life.
One of the standard examples is people have in their head a vacation fund. And so they, you know, earn $100 and they say, in my head, that's earmarked for my trip to the Hawaii Dermatology Seminar next year. And so it surprised me at first that economists don't think this is a good idea. But I think the thought is that a dollar that you have is supposed to just be a useful dollar for whatever utility is appropriate, like now, rather than like mentally filing it away for something in particular. And one of the examples that you use in the book that's applicable to medicine is refers to a psoriasis CME event, perhaps when you were running, Dr. Feldman, where the coordinator had suggested a small fee, always improved attendance. So it was like $15. So sort of like a grocery store coupon. Probably none of these dermatologists are going to care too much about $15. But even though apparently the weather was terrible, there was an ice storm, everybody still showed up anyway. And your thinking was that if they hadn't paid $15 in advance, they probably wouldn't have shown up.
Yeah, one guy came over the mountains of West Virginia, ice-covered roads at the peril of his life because he had invested $15 in this meeting. You know, a part of this could be loss aversion. Part of it could be the sense that when you're invested in something, you're going to take advantage of it. But maybe that is a form of mental accounting that we do.
I think so. And I think there are a lot of ways in which these concepts overlap with each other. And remember, they're all ways to try to understand human behavior. It's hard for me to think of any of them as real, but they're useful models to try to understand how people work. And I think this is related to this loss aversion or maybe the sunk cost phenomenon, where if you pay money for something, you feel like you have to take advantage of it. My family once, for example, paid some money to go on like a fun sleigh ride up in the mountains in around Salt Lake City. But when we got there, it was like super snowy and icy and the kids just wanted to go home. And they talked about like the horse had slipped earlier that day or something.
Oh, my gosh. Like,
we just should not have gone on the sleigh ride, even though we had spent $50 for it or whatever. I like to think of us spending money for stuff as we pay to have the option to do that thing if we decide to do it when the time comes.
I think that's a great way to look at it. These mental accounts are a form of predictable irrationality because that dollar, you know, and how you spend it should be independent of whether you've invested ahead of time or not. You should be making the decisions rationally. If we said to that dermatologist, hey, we'll pay you $15 to come over this ice-covered mountain, he'd be like, no way, I'm not doing that.
Cost me $15 in gas. One other point you brought up in this chapter is that maybe one reason that some people are reluctant to pay for their medicines is because they don't have a mental account that says medicines on it. Perhaps they don't have chronic conditions and so they don't normally buy medicines, but we as physicians get frustrated that they have a cigarette account, so they think nothing about spending $100 a month or whatever it is on their cigarettes, but they won't go and buy their whatever triamcinolone cream for $5.
Yes, I think they have a mental account for the insurance, and the insurance should pay for it, and they shouldn't have to pay anything. You know, that brings up all kinds of economic issues, but I think it does make it hard for them to be willing to pay even modest amounts for something when they think somebody else is supposed to be paying for it for them.
I was going to say, it's weird, but there's this sort of strange double accounting our brains do sometimes. When our brains think we're paying for something twice, it's like quite an anathema to our brains. Like you give the example in the book of having a ticket for a movie and the ticket costs $10 and you lose the ticket. So you get to the theater and you realize you don't have it and they can't replace it and you have to buy another one to see the movie. Are you going to buy that ticket? And a lot of, like in the study, only 46% of people would buy the ticket again to see the movie they were at the theater to see since they'd already spent $10, doubling effectively the cost of the ticket. But then in that same study, they presented people with the scenario, you lose $10 walking into the movie theater, you just drop it out of your wallet. But you get there and the tickets cost $10. Do you go ahead and buy your ticket? And almost twice as many people were comfortable buying the ticket. And I think it was because in their mental accounting, they weren't counting that as paying for it twice. Like our brains hate to pay for something twice. And it makes us really kind of resist that option, almost like it's, you know, a taboo to us or it's something like distasteful.
Yeah, I need to study that.
One little lever you mentioned at the end of the chapter is if somebody is unwilling to pay for a medication, you might comment that, well, you're already spending money for your health insurance. So if you use your health insurance, you get this $100 medicine for only $15. Isn't that a great deal? And I'm honestly not sure exactly how that slots into the mental accounting thing, but it's at least a way to convince people that maybe there's something behind your recommendation.
Well, that's playing on the same circuits that sales work on, right? You're getting this $50 value for only $9.99, you know?
Yeah. How you present things would have an enormous impact. If you didn't want them to buy it, you could tell them, you've already paid for health insurance and now they're going to make you pay $15 more?
That's true.
Behavioral economics is how things are presented.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost creepy how susceptible we are. I feel like sometimes we talk about it and we're under this illusion that we don't fall into these traps, but obviously we do.
Mm-hmm. Black Friday is a prime example of it. I saw something that I had already ordered weeks before and it came as a Black Friday sale in my Instagram feed. And I was like mad for a second. I was like, damn it, I already bought that. But then I looked at it and their Black Friday sale price was the same as the sale price I'd bought like the thing for 3 weeks anterior to this. And I was like, then I felt better. And I was like, this shouldn't affect me, but it does.
You're so predictably irrational, Michelle.
I know, very predictably irrational.
All right. Well, thanks, Steve, for joining us. We'll plan to see you again, not probably next time because that's the Dermy Awards, but hopefully the next time. So you'll be a little New Year's present for our listeners then as well.
I hope it works out. Thank you.
Thank you.
Michelle, let's talk about some articles.
I've got a great one here. This is out of Curious. Sorry, I think it's Curious. Not curious like are you curious, but C-U-R-E-U-S. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it correctly, but that's how I'm reading it.
So Curious George is a dermatologist would spell it that way.
I think he probably would. I think that's the way he would spell it. So
would
if you
he have a tail? Because if you ever watch Curious George, it's curious that he doesn't have a tail even though he's a monkey.
He should have a tail. Would he have had it like... That's sad, but sometimes when they make animals pets, they kind of nip their tails. Although that would be such a mean thing to do for a monkey because they use that almost as an extra limb. Anyway, I digress. You know what other kinds of cells are interesting?
Tell me.
So there's a kind of cell called a mast cell. Now, do you know what the word, why we call them mast cells, Luke? This is actually kind of funny.
I admit that I don't.
So Mastzellen is actually a German word for overfed cells. And so when the German dermatopathologist Paul Ehrlich saw the mast cells under the microscope, he saw their cytoplasm full of granules. And so he decided they were overfed. So they're overfed cells. Isn't that interesting?
So mast is the German word for overfed?
Mast, basically, yeah. Isn't that cute?
It's interesting that the Germans have such a short, simple word to convey that idea. Do a lot of Germans get overfed?
Well, around certain times of the year, absolutely. I think it's a part of the festivities. But so I think of the mast cells sort of as, you know, Augustus Gloop under the microscope with all of the granules and such in the cytoplasm. So mast cells are fascinating. They have a lot of things that they do that are important in our body, but sometimes they decide to misbehave. And fortunately, there is now a medication to help treat this misbehavior of systemic mastocytosis. So this article out of Curious is the role of avapritinib in the treatment of systemic mastocytosis. Avapritinib is a small molecule inhibitor and is actually able to inhibit tyrosine kinase as well as the specific mutation that can cause systemic mastocytosis. So I shall ding the bell for this. So mastocytosis exists in three broad categories. There's cutaneous mastocytosis, which we're all familiar with. So that would be solitary mastocytomas, multiple mastocytomas, what we used to call urticaria pigmentosa, those kinds of things. That's the cutaneous mastocytosis. Then there are the systemic mastocytosis. There are five types of systemic mastocytosis. There's indolent systemic mastocytosis. These patients have a normal lifespan, and they just have mast cell hyperplasia typically evident in their bone marrow, but not necessarily a lot of symptomatic disease due to the hyperproliferation of the mast cells. There's smoldering systemic mastocytosis. These patients are more symptomatic, but still don't have the more significant features of aggressive systemic mastocytosis, or ASM, not ASMR, but ASM. So we've had indolent systemic mastocytosis, which is ISM, smoldering systemic mastocytosis, which is SSM, aggressive systemic mastocytosis, which is ASM, and then systemic mastocytosis with an associated hematologic neoplasm, which is SM-AHN, and then finally mast cell leukemia. So those are the five types of systemic mastocytosis. And then finally, there's mast cell sarcoma, which tends to happen in making a solid tumor of atypical mast cells, usually not in the skin. So we're not usually taking care of patients with mast cell sarcoma. So that's the lay of the land of the mast cell dyscrasias, cutaneous, systemic, or mast cell sarcoma. So we're going to be focusing on systemic mastocytosis, which we've just delineated those five phenotypes of systemic mastocytosis. This is a rare hematologic disorder, and these authors, Vikram Sumbli and Vincent Rizzo out of Mount Sinai, New York, have done a great job of delineating them and then discussing a new and effective therapy for them. Systemic mastocytosis is fortunately a rare hematologic disorder where you have a clonal proliferation of mast cells in extracutaneous organs. And we've just discussed those five different phenotypic divisions of systemic mastocytosis. The tyrosine kinase inhibitor and also potent inhibitor of the mutation that causes most systemic mastocytosis, which is KIT D816V inhibitor, KIT D816V, that's the mutation. So avapritinib is able to inhibit that. This medication has been improved for the treatment of GISTs or gastrointestinal stromal tumors in the past that had a platelet-derived growth factor receptor mutation in exon 18. This medication has also shown promise in patients with systemic mastocytosis, which is caused by this mutation in KIT, this D816V. So when we have a mutation where we say a letter, a number, and another letter, I think it's good to kind of understand what that means because we've heard other ones like this, right? We've heard of BRAF V600E, right? That's also got a V in it. What does that mean? These are single letter abbreviations for amino acids that are encoded by the DNA. So when you have a mutation, like for example, the one that causes systemic mastocytosis, which is the KIT D816V, that first letter is the amino acid that was supposed to be there. In this case, aspartate. Its abbreviation is D. I have no idea why it's D, but it's D. There's not a D in aspartate. I didn't make the rules. So aspartate's initial is D. Then 816 is the position in the DNA, protein chain of where the mutation has affected the amino acid being encoded. And then V is for valine. So for the V600E, that's actually supposed to be a valine that gets turned into a glutamic acid whose letter for some reason is E. So we've got this mutation in KIT. This KIT D816V mutation that causes systemic mastocytosis. The reason it's important that that change happens is it actually causes a gain of function mutation in the KIT gene. So it actually liberates the KIT gene from needing to have stimulation by stem cell factor, which it normally needs to proliferate. If you have the mutation D816V in your KIT, you don't actually need the stem cell factor anymore. You can autophosphorylize yourself. So you actually don't need stimulation for that autophosphorylation, and that autophosphorylization then facilitates uncontrolled cell growth and tumorigenesis. So when I read the name avapritinib, it reminded me of avapirone. Avapirone, who you guys may have heard the name of, also went by the name of Evita and was memorialized in the sometimes controversial musical. But I wrote a little ditty to the tune of her most famous song, Don't Cry for Me, Argentina.
I love it.
So we can remember all these things about avapritinib, like avapirone. Are you guys ready?
I'm ready.
All right, so it's ready. Don't function tyrosine kinase. KIT D816V, stop that. That's the mutation for mastocytosis. DV substitution and gain of function. Now KIT don't need stem cell factor, and it autophosphorylizes. This makes the mast cells grow uncontrolled fashion, stopping mastocytosis. That is my passion as avapritinib. Thank you very much. Thank you.
I bet you were a lot of fun in high school, Michelle. Not that you're not a lot of fun now.
My brain does this involuntarily, so I feel like sometimes I might as well share it with other people. So the genetic change that you see here causes uncontrolled differentiation or uncontrolled proliferation of the mast cells. Men are more prone to the KIT D816V mutation, and they're also more likely to acquire advanced forms of systemic mastocytosis with worse overall survival and progression-free survival. So that is something that you need to pay attention to if these patients are presenting in your clinic. There are other mutations that can predispose to more aggressive forms of systemic mastocytosis, and I'll only touch on these briefly. Mutations in TET2, SRSF2, as well as a couple of other genetic things such as RUNX1. If these are mutated, then you're more likely to have a more aggressive form of systemic mastocytosis, and it can be harder to treat with earlier iterations of tyrosine kinase inhibitors. So to diagnose systemic mastocytosis, this is important and very pimpable in my opinion, the patients need to have a bone marrow biopsy because you're looking for the presence of dense multifocal mast cells within the bone marrow, which is a pathognomonic mnemonic feature of systemic mastocytosis. So the marrow tissue should be screened under the microscope for morphologic abnormalities, and then they should also be looked at with either flow cytometry or immunohistochemistry, and you're looking for aberrant expression of different clusters of differentiation markers. So mast cells should not produce CD2, CD25, or CD30, but in systemic mastocytosis, they can express these aberrantly. CD2 is supposed to be expressed in T cells, NK cells, thymocytes, and dendritic cells. CD25 is supposed to be expressed in activated T cells and autoimmune disease. You see this elevated. You also see it marking adult T cell leukemia in patients affected with the human T cell lymphoma virus 1 or HTLV1 virus. That's important because under the microscope and clinically, it can mimic mycosis fungoides but has CD25 positivity. In areas with high endemic populations of patients who are affected by HTLV1, if you diagnose MF, you have to first screen with CD25 to make sure you're not actually dealing with adult T cell leukemia lymphoma. And then finally, CD30, this is an activation antigen that's expressed in sort of different kind of immunoblasts. It can be expressed with EBV infection, in Hodgkin's lymphoma, diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, anaplastic large cell lymphoma, other CD30 positive lymphoproliferative diseases, including lymphomatoid papillosis. But again, normal mast cells are not supposed to express CD30. So aberrant expression of CD2, CD25, or CD30 in mast cells is something you can also see in patients with systemic mastocytosis. You can also look at the mast cells with CD117 or mast cell tryptase, and tryptase is sometimes followed to follow the severity of this disease. High sensitivity PCR can find this KIT D816V mutation that's pathognomonic for the condition, and the serum tryptase levels are important in diagnosing and tracking the condition. They also recommend doing a DEXA scan, bone x-ray studies, and abdominal ultrasounds for staging for these patients. And to make the diagnosis of systemic mastocytosis, there's updated 2016 WHO guidelines that require the presence of one major and one minor criterion, or three minor criteria. So the major criterion is multifocal dense infiltrates of mast cells, which is more than 15 cells in aggregates, in sections of the bone marrow or other extracutaneous organs. So that's your major criteria. Your minor criteria are tryptase levels more than 20 nanograms per milliliter, abnormal mast cell CD25 expression. Remember, they're not supposed to express that. Presence of the KIT D816V mutation, or presence of more than 25% atypical mast cells. They also then talk about B and C findings, and that helps to segregate these systemic mastocytoses into either indolent, smoldering, or aggressive.
It's probably not going to be us doing all this, though, right? This is oncology stuff.
It's probably not. And so I'm not going to delve too deeply into this. The B findings talk about the mast cell burden in the bone marrow. It also talks about signs of dysplasia or myeloproliferation in non-mast cell lineages. So that could be one that has the hematologic malignancy associated with the systemic mastocytosis and hepatomegaly. The C findings, which can be present in aggressive systemic mastocytosis, include pancytopenia or cytopenia of red blood cells, platelets, or neutrophils, palpable hepatomegaly, skeletal involvement with osteolytic lesions, or malabsorption and weight loss. So all of those can correlate with aggressive systemic mastocytosis. And then mast cell leukemia requires more than 20% of mast cells in the bone marrow. So that's all about the staging of mastocytoses. When you look at patients who have advanced systemic mastocytosis, they actually had a very good response rate to avapritinib. So their overall response rate was 77%. Which is awesome. Their overall survival rate was 78%, even in patients with advanced systemic mastocytosis. So this medication was very effective for them as compared to the previous tyrosine kinase inhibitors that had 60, 30, and 21% effectiveness against systemic mastocytosis. This was with older tyrosine kinase inhibitors. The reason the first generation of tyrosine kinase inhibitors didn't do as well for systemic mastocytosis is that that first generation was only able to bind to the inactive conformation of the enzyme KIT. And that's specifically targeting mutations at exon 11. But as we know, mutations accrue in a malignancy. And so you can get something called steric hindrance, where further mutations actually get in the way of the first generation tyrosine kinase inhibitors working in systemic mastocytosis as mutations are acquired. And what's nice is the avapritinib actually doesn't bind to the inactive conformation like the first generation tyrosine kinase inhibitors. It actually binds to the constitutively active version of the KIT enzyme, which is what you're dealing with in systemic mastocytosis, which may be why it's much more effective than previous generations of tyrosine kinase inhibitors. One other interesting thing is that avapritinib seems to restore chemosensitivity to cells possessing mutations in ATP binding cassettes, such as ABCB1, which, if that sounds familiar, it should, because we discussed it in episode 35 when we talked about a patient that actually went into a coma after being treated with ivermectin for scabies because he had haploinsufficiency of the ABCB1 gene due to mutations, different mutations in both sides of his family. And so the ABCB1 gene is an ATP binding cassette transporter. It's important for drug efflux, and it's important in managing the drug levels of things like ivermectin, opioids, and seizure drugs, amongst other medications. So these ATP binding cassettes can actually change. They can be overexpressed in tumor cells. And what's interesting is the avapritinib can actually restore chemosensitivity to cells that are doing this, which also makes it a more efficacious therapeutic for patients with even aggressive systemic mastocytosis. So it's really exciting to have a medication that actually works for this set of diseases that have been very difficult to treat in the past. Fortunately, they're relatively rare, only about 4.6 cases per 1 million adults. They tend to occur more commonly in middle-aged Caucasians.
I was inspired to look into this article because a colleague of mine at the University of Utah, shout out to Dr. Lauren Madigan, is a mastocytosis expert and mentioned this drug during a great Grand Rounds presentation. So thanks, Dr. Madigan, for bringing avapritinib to our attention and inspiring this article. I think it's nice to know that for dermatologists that there is a drug out there that's specific for systemic mastocytosis now, and that it looks like it's pretty effective and pretty well tolerated. So a good reason to connect these people with our oncology colleagues. Also, one other point that she mentioned was that if you have an adult patient and you biopsy them and you find mast cells in the skin, you can't call them cutaneous mastocytosis because the definition of cutaneous mastocytosis is you have mastocytosis only in the skin. What you could say is that they have mastocytosis in the skin, and then you have to look closely to make sure they don't have mastocytosis elsewhere. That's not true in kids when something like maculopapular cutaneous mastocytosis, which we discussed in the last episode, is pretty common. Kids don't usually have these systemic versions of it. She did present one case of an 18 or 19-year-old patient who had what everybody thought was maculopapular cutaneous mastocytosis for like her whole life, and it turned out it was one of these things after all, or perhaps it progressed. We normally don't think of that entity as progressing, so that's kind of concerning. So I suppose I should follow my maculopapular cutaneous mastocytosis patients, you know, every year or so, I guess, just to make sure they're not developing some kind of systemic disease.
Very interesting family of diseases. And I think that D816V mutation in KIT is very testable just because of its pathomechanism, the fact that it causes gain of function and allows for KIT to autophosphorylize, which allows for then uncontrolled proliferation outside of the influence of stem cell factor. Pretty cool.
Well, speaking of something that other types of doctors generally deal with, I want to pull an article out of the Annals of Rheumatologic Disease from the year 2020. Called Paradoxical Gastrointestinal Effects of Interleukin-17 Blockers. Authors are out of France and include Marine Fonny and Laurent Perrin-Biroulet. Apologize for the mispronunciation. So in our last episode, we talked about this newly approved medicine called bimekizumab, which looks really good for psoriasis. Mm-hmm. It's an IL-17 blocker, and that article mentioned an increased prevalence of inflammatory bowel disease, or IBD, in patients treated with IL-17 blockers. So I wanted to look into it so I could properly counsel my patients if I decide to put them on some of these medicines. And that's what this review is about. So it's a review of published data, mostly clinical trials, but also some case reports. So why would people on IL-17 blockers get somehow worsening or new IBD? Well, the pathomechanism is presumably related to the fact that there are these Th17 cells. So for a long time, we just had Th1 and Th2 cells. But back in 2005, people discovered that there was, in fact, another kind of Th cell. Maybe there's like 60 more kinds out there. Who knows? But instead of calling it Th3, which most people would think would make sense, they actually named it after one of the cytokines it was already known to produce, which had already been named IL-17. So they called these things Th17 cells. By the way, they also produced IL-21 and IL-22. But they don't call them Th21 cells or Th22 cells. Nope, they call them Th17 cells, not Th3 cells. By the way, if you're wondering how IL-23 factors into this, because some of our other psoriasis biologics are IL-23 blockers, well, dendritic cells, macrophages, and monocytes secrete IL-23. Ding, ding. And the IL-23 helps maintain and expand the population of Th17 cells. Anywho, these Th17 cells are prevalent on the walls of mucosal surfaces, especially the intestines, where they are important in protecting against bacterial and fungal infections. And remember that our IL-17 patients get more thrush, probably as a result of this particular issue. By the way, according to this article, there's also apparently a different subset of IL-17 producing immune cells called ILC3 cells that also live in our gut mucosa. Who knew? And type 1 interferon may also be involved in why we might get IBD after starting one of these drugs, just like it is in the TNF inhibitor-induced psoriasiform eruption. And then there was also a commentary on this article by Drs. Pankti Mehta, Abel Lawrence, and Amit Agarwal, and they pointed out that blocking IL-17 may interfere with a complicated regulatory loop involving IL-24. So we still don't quite know the pathomechanism, but people are working on it. Smart people doing good studies, so maybe we'll figure it out someday. But those are current theories as to why this might be happening. So most studies do indeed show an increased risk of IBD in patients treated with anti-IL-17 agents. This was published 3 years ago, so bimekizumab wasn't available, but these were ixekizumab, secukinumab, and brodalumab. One meta-analysis in 2019, encompassing 38 trials and about 17,000 patients, suggested an incidence of about 2.4 per 1,000 patient years of IBD in these patients. So is that a lot? Well, the annual incidence of IBD in the general population is somewhat region-dependent and is variable, but it looks like it's about 0.1 per 1,000 people, annual incidence, so 2.4 is definitely a higher rate. By the way, in those bimekizumab trials we discussed in our last episode, two patients out of 1,300 on the drug developed IBD, so also about 2.4 per 1,000 patient years. However, this review also pointed out one recent review that compared the risk of IBD development in patients with psoriasis, with psoriatic arthritis, or with ankylosing spondylitis, either exposed to IL-17 drugs or not, and found no difference. Perhaps suggesting that the incidence of IBD in these populations is just high, like higher than the general population. This was a 2020 study encompassing 66 trials and about 14,000 patients. On the other hand, a lot of the clinical trials for these drugs, there were no particular IBD spikes in the placebo groups, at least to my knowledge, so there's probably at least something there. The time to develop GI symptoms after you started one of these anti-IL-17 drugs was quite variable, 1 week to 5 years. The average was 1 year. Good news, discontinuing the causative drug led to, quote, substantial improvement of symptoms in most of the case reports that have been published. They don't say, like, remission or resolution, the substantial improvement of symptoms. And again, that's where case reports. There's something like 20, 25 case reports of people who developed IBD after starting one of these drugs, and then you get sort of the full history. And a lot of the trial data, it says, you know, we had two cases of IBD, but they don't really tell you what happened to the patient. So that's at least nice that we can discontinue the drug and have a decent chance that someone might just get better. These authors of this particular review recommend careful screening for personal GI symptoms and family history of IBD before starting an IL-17 drug, though they do point out that plenty of patients without these risk factors developed IBD in the trials and in the case reports. They also recommend a baseline fecal calprotectin test, which requires a stool sample mm-hmm. and checks for intestinal inflammation. And if the value is abnormal, they recommend consulting GI before moving on to an IL-17 drug. Anti-IL-17 drugs can worsen IBD and can put patients with IBD at increased risk of infection, so they are contraindicated in patients with active IBD, according to these authors. You could use them in patients with quiescent IBD, perhaps, but other drugs are preferred, they say. A couple other notes that came out of here. Secukinumab and ixekizumab, which are also called Cosentyx and Taltz, block a particular isoform of IL-17. Nothing is simple in the human body. It's really miraculous that it works at all. Called yep. IL-17A. Bimekizumab blocks IL-17A and F. Nobody ever talks about B through E, but A and F certainly are isoforms we pay attention to. And brodalumab, also called Cilic, blocks the IL-17 receptor rather than the molecules themselves, and has this REMS program about suicidality. Something else I didn't know about inflammatory bowel disease, apparently the pathomechanism, they say, is abnormal immune response to normal microbiota. So their recommendations honestly seem quite conservative. If the incidence rate is quite low, if I treat 1,000 patients, then 2.4 of them will get IBD. And it looks like a lot of them will just get better if I stop the drug. And I'm already screening them for these risk factors of GI symptoms and family history. Is the fecal calprotectin test really necessary? It's not an expensive test. It's like $20 and it's like not even invasive, but still it's sort of off-putting to tell a patient they have to poop in a bowl before you can start them on this medicine. What do you think?
You know, if I've got a patient that has any worrisome history at all, I think that ordering the fetal calprotectin is reasonable to do. Like you said, it's an inexpensive test. It's inconvenient because they have to get a specimen cup. They have to go home. They have to collect the specimen. They have to bring it back. Some people have very strong feelings about this. You know, you have to kind of try to destigmatize it with the patient. You know, like, this is just a test like any other lab test. I know this one feels more personal, but I promise that the lab personnel don't care. They just want to get the test done so they can go on with their day. And I think that if you've got any, like sometimes you get stuck between like rock hard place, chainsaw, Freddy Krueger, you know, when you have somebody that has comorbidities that make it hard to choose which medication they might benefit from the most. And so I think a baseline calprotectin under those circumstances might help you to make a good decision for the patient. But I agree that utilizing it as standard practice is probably not something most people are going to do.
Well, overall, this article was fairly reassuring. I normally think of IL-17 drugs as really quite safe. I was a little disturbed by this IBD comment, but, you know, I feel more educated now. Also, speaking of price, avapritinib, remember Eva Peron bought a whole bunch of shoes, so she was
sure
probably
did.
Pretty pricey. And avapritinib mm-hmm. is no different. It's about $39,000 per month.
Wow. Holy you could buy pro. A whole lot of shoes with that. That's a lot of shoes.
Sure could. Mm-hmm. Well, Michelle, this is episode 120.
Yes, it is.
So we all know what that means.
Woo!
It means we're going to remember all the things we learned over the past 10 episodes. What we like to call the Dermosphere Clip Show. If you remember like the old TV episodes, like the season finale of season one of Star Trek, The Next Generation, they just sort of like revisit all of the mediocre episodes that came before. So they don't have any real new content. That's what we strive for here at Dermosphere, to be as much like season one of Next Generation as possible.
It was a great show. I loved that show.
I loved it too. But it did have a lot of mediocrity in retrospect. Unlike us, though. But we know we forget things, so I think it helps us to remind ourselves the things we learned, and in case we feel like going back and revisiting it, we can. So, if you remember episode 111, you might remember that that's the episode where I talked about some things I learned from the Society for Pediatric Dermatology meeting. You might mm-hmm. also remember that we discussed the clinical trial that got ritlecitinib approved for the use of alopecia areata. The brand name is Litfulo. I've prescribed it for a good handful of patients now. It's approved for age 12 plus. It seems to have really good results in about a third of patients and all right results in another 50% or so. You might also remember that we talked about VEXOS syndrome. Michelle, I'm sure you remember what VEXIS stands for.
It's so hot right now. I know there's vacuoles, which is important because you see vacuoles in the cells in the bone marrow. And it's the ubiquinone mutation, I believe, is part of the syndrome.
That's right. That's what we talked about.
And it tends to happen in dudes.
Yep.
And it's like adult onset autoinflammatory disease. And it's like an acronym. Let's see. Hold on. What is the acronym?
Yes. I wasn't actually asking you to do my job for me.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Remembering this one. But I'm glad you did. Thanks.
Oh,
yes.
Thank
the
you.
Gene
thank
is
you very much.
UBA1, which includes.
And it's
ubiquinin.
On the X chromosome. That's why it happens more to dudes.
And that's why the X is in there. It stands for X-linked. Mm-hmm. So yes, new onset, sort of weird, nonspecific, autoinflammatory / autoimmune phenotype in men in their like 40s-60s with polymorphic, nonspecific skin stuff. Think VEXIS syndrome. Mm-hmm. Speaking of inflammatory stuff, we talked about the soluble IL-2 receptor. Have you ever seen your rheumatology colleagues order it? Well, if so, listen to this episode and you'll find out why. It's definitely a marker of inflammation, but there's some more under the hood. And then we also talked about Botox, actually botulinum toxin type B, but we can be pretty sure they're similar in effect for hidradenitis suppurativa. That was a little trial of about 20 patients that was open label, but they got substantially better. I've used it since then on one or two patients, and I am sorry to say they did not improve. I think I keep running into this problem of trying to turn on the fire hose after the house is burned down. I got to catch mm-hmm. people while their houses are still just smoking or they've just left the gas on. They don't seem to come to the dermatologist at that point, though.
Yeah. We got to work with our community partners, for sure.
What did we learn in episode 112, Michelle?
A lot of things. So we started off in episode 112 with an article from one of our friends of the show. And I think you were an author on this article too, Hair Regrowth with Tattooing. So it discussed a retrospective analysis of patients who underwent tattooing with minoxidil 0.05%, dutasteride 0.1% to a depth of 1.5 millimeters with a 27 gauge needle in a tattoo machine. So a proper tattoo machine, just like you would use to put a decorative tattoo. So they had three sessions each 1 month apart, and then they had baseline photos and then therapeutic photos that were de-identified. The baseline SALT score improved overall from 60 to 40% at 4 months, and the primary outcome, which was total scalp area regrowth, was greater than 10% in over half of their patients, about 53% of their patients, and almost 30% of them got more than 20% top scalp area regrowth. If they had vellus hairs present at baseline, they had a higher likelihood of regrowing hair because vellus hairs show you opportunity. We also talked about tapering of dupilumab. This was a study out of the British Journal of Dermatology in which they looked at trying to increase the dosing interval between injections of dupilumab for cost savings for a nationalized system. And they were able to successfully taper patients from every 2 week injections to every 3 or every 4 weeks with significant but small increases in the EASI scores and the NRS, which is the numeric rating scale for pruritus. The scores remained relatively low and the condition was manageable with topical therapeutics along with the dupilumab. So they were able to successfully taper those patients. We talked about how to help avoiding needle sticks. Most of this is common sense stuff. They had some great tips, avoiding hand-to-hand passage of sharps, have an organized surgical tray, optimize the surgical environment, utilize no-touch techniques when you're trying to adjust the suture and the needle driver. That's something that I have a hard time making myself not do, but I always try not to touch the needle because I'm trying to model good behavior for my residents. And then also utilizing potentially safety devices, not recapping needles, things like that, and disposing of used syringes immediately. I also think having multiple sharps containers in the room so you don't have to walk around the room with a sharp helps. We talked about narrow-toed shoes and the toe-to-toe sign. For some reason, we keep making shoes in a shape that feet are not shaped like. These pointy-toed shoes keep coming back into style for some maddening reason. And so the authors suggested taking the patient's shoe and pointing it toward their toes and kind of showing them how little room they actually have for their toes when they're presenting with nail disorders, because the microtrauma or macrotrauma that's caused by wearing these tight-fitting shoes can exacerbate chronic diseases like ingrown nails, cause onycholysis, onychalcosis, which is overgrowth and thickening of the nail, onychogryphosis, which is like the ram's horn nail deformity. And it just kind of shows the patient why their toes might not be in the very best shape. We also talked about congenital hypertrophy of the hallux nail folds. The lateral nail fold can become hypertrophic, and that can partially cover the nail plate and be associated with ingrown toenails, inflammation, and pain. It may regress on its own, but in the study, that was not common. It can also cause choelenichia and be associated with congenital malalignment. Differential diagnosis can include things like periungual fibroma, and you have to be able to distinguish the inflammatory phase of this congenital hypertrophy from bacterial perionychia.
In episode 113, I think you were sick. So speaking of clip shows, we
Yes, this was a clip show.
Some recordings from previous episodes. The theme was recently approved dermatologic medications. So we talked about upadacitinib for atopic dermatitis. It works
selective JAK1 inhibitor.
Yes, it works quite well and it's quite safe. We talked about also tralokinumab for atopic dermatitis. An IL-13 inhibitor like dupilumab is, so as you might guess, it works very well and is quite safe. One of the more interesting things that came out of that trial was that there were some patients who had durable remission even after discontinuing the drug, so that's cool. We talked about baricitinib for alopecia areata, very similar to the ritlecitinib that I discussed before, though this one's approved for only age 18 plus currently. Speaking of JAK inhibitors, we also talked about deucravacitinib for psoriasis. I think it's the only JAK inhibitor actually approved for psoriasis. It seems to be, I would say, probably the best oral medicine for psoriasis in terms of efficacy and tolerability, though the biologics are probably better at both. And we talked about a topical medicine called Spinosad for scabies. Seems pretty decent. A lot of people got improvement after just a single application, I believe. It's fairly inexpensive. I want to say like $70, so it could be an option if they can't tolerate other things. I don't think I would still go to it first line.
Very cool. In episode 114, we talked about UV nail drivers and dryers and their ability to cause DNA damage with Dr. Julia Curtis. UVA light, which is emitted by the UV nail polish drivers, have been implicated in causing the potential increase of risk of skin cancer on the dorsal hands, but no experimental evaluation had been undertaken. So they actually used mouse embryonic fibroblasts and human foreskin fibroblasts, as well as human epidermal keratinocytes, to determine whether or not actual damage was happening in a measurable fashion due to these UVA lights used for nail drying. And they were able to establish that there were high levels of reactive oxygen species, and they ended up having DNA damage as well as mitochondrial dysfunction and somatic mutations with dose-dependent increase of C to G to A to T substitutions, which are consistent with UV radiation-induced gene mutations. We talked about a new cantharidin device for the application of molluscum. It has 0.7% cantharidin, acetone, gentian violet, and denatonium benzoate in a little applicator that's very reminiscent of the Dermabond applicator. And even the liquid inside of it is purple because there's gentian violet in there. So it looks very similar. So don't mess those two up. You don't want to like put the cantharidin. Is it cantharone? Is that the name of the little device? It has a name. But you wouldn't want to mix those up and use them in the wrong situation. And in this study, Ycanth. That's right. It's Ycanth. So this is for, in this study, they looked at patients greater than 2 years of age, and they either used the medication or the vehicle. They were able to demonstrate that a significantly higher percentage of participants had complete molluscum clearance with the active therapy versus the vehicle, which makes sense. And the adverse events were the ones you would predict with cantharidin. So application site blistering, pruritus, pain, and erythema. But these were mild and or moderate in severity and didn't cause discontinuation. We talked about neoadjuvant treatment with imiquimod for lentigo maligna. Remember that neoadjuvant means that you're using it before you do the definitive therapy. So this was a retrospective medical record review from 334 patients with 345 biopsy confirmed lentigo malignas. They were treated with imiquimod prior to undergoing staged excision at the University of Utah. And the neoadjuvant topical imiquimod cream prior to the conservatively staged excision allowed for negative histologic margins with a median final margin of 2 millimeters and a rate of recurrence similar to reported recurrence rates for standard staged excisions by Mohs or on-foss permanent sections. So very good clearance with that neoadjuvant treatment. We talked about TNF inhibitor-induced psoriasis in children. This was a multi-center retrospective case series with children younger than 18 years of age who developed new-onset psoriasiform eruption on a TNF inhibitor for a non-dermatologic disorder. And the authors found that these eruptions were seen In children treated for any indication with a TNF inhibitor. And there was a, so this was a class effect with varying TNF inhibitors. The majority of the children were able to continue TNF inhibitor therapy with adequate skin-directed or other adjuvant therapies. And so you were able to treat through the side effect of TNF inhibitor induced psoriasis in most of these kids. We talked about memantine for trichotillomania and skin picking. Memantine, as y'all know, is an antagonist of the NMDA receptor subtype glutamate receptor and is used in the therapy of Alzheimer's disease. In patients with trichotillosis, they enrolled 86 women and the rest of them were all men, which is not unusual for this condition. It tends to kind of significantly tilt towards ladies. This was a double-blind trial of memantine versus placebo, and they were looked at with various measures for pulling or plucking severity. Outcomes were then evaluated, and they were able to determine that compared with placebo, memantine treatment was associated with significant improvements in multiple functional scales, and 60.5% of participants in the memantine group were much or very much improved, compared with only 8% in the placebo group. So 60% versus 8% looks pretty significant. The memantine treatment resulted in significant reductions in hair picking or pulling, and also was tended to be well tolerated. So the glutamate system might be a good target for compulsive behavior control.
In episode 115, we said goodbye to some of the members of Team Dermosphere who have been working on the show. They're not actually gone yet, but they're on their way. So Angie Wong talked about baricitinib for lichen planus. Is there anything these JAK inhibitors can't do? Looked effective in her case series there. Morgan Dykeman came to talk about epidermolysis bullosa patients and how to properly transition them from pediatric to adult care. Guy Kusecki joined us to talk about isotretinoin and IUDs. Michael Birdsall joined us to talk about visual racism in med school. No surprise, it's there, and we should do something about it, and we are doing something about it, and it's really not that hard. And Eleonora Marcacci talked about rural and underserved dermatology. We appreciate all you guys coming to talk to us, and listeners, go back and listen. They're all dynamite.
Awesome sauce. In episode 116, we talked about mixing intralesional Kenalog with lidocaine and epinephrine for the treatment of alopecia areata. And this is a modification of an already broadly used therapy with intralesional Kenalog. They just advocate for adding lidocaine with epinephrine. The epinephrine may serve to sequester the corticosteroid in the tissue target longer and thereby provide a greater possibility of treatment response. So these were patients they were assessing in this short case review that had been recalcitrant to previous injections with intralesional Kenalog, but when they added the modification of the epinephrine, they started to respond to the shots and actually had sustainable improvement. Luke also talked about highlights from the Intermountain Dermatologic Society, and we discussed the use of isotretinoin for rosacea. Specifically, these patients were actually given just one dose per week of isotretinoin, and they were compared to minocycline 100 milligrams daily, and they had relatively equal response rates. So this low-dose isotretinoin regimen seems to be relatively efficacious for patients with severe to moderate rosacea. For the moderate rosacea, they had a complete response in 10% of patients and partial response in 28% of patients, which was a pretty nice response compared to 8% response with minocycline 100 milligrams daily and 33% response for the moderate patients. So this was once weekly dose of low-dose isotretinoin for the treatment of papulopustular rosacea. We talked about leukotriene receptor antagonist for chronic urticaria. This was a systematic review, and the trials were relatively heterogeneous, but they were able to demonstrate that while in monotherapy, leukotriene receptor antagonists are not able to be recommended for the treatment of chronic urticaria, in combination with antihistamines or other therapeutics, they might add more efficaciousness and work in a synergistic fashion. So you do need to be aware, if you are going to use leukotriene receptor antagonists, that there are black boxes on them for neuropsychiatric events. And so if you have a patient that you feel might be at high risk for that, that might not be your preferred therapeutic. We talked about JAK inhibitors for hidradenitis suppurativa and reviewed a retrospective cohort study of 20 patients at a single institution who were treated with upadacitinib, a JAK1 selective inhibitor. They were started at 15 milligrams daily with possible therapeutic titration to 30 milligrams daily and followed for 24 weeks. They were screened appropriately for infectious conditions, as you should for any patient you're starting on a JAK inhibitor. And they also checked baseline fasting lipids, creatinine kinase, and a blood count. They also followed these values throughout treatment, and they were able to achieve a high score of 50 and 75% of patients at 4 weeks, which increased to 100% at week 12, maintained to week 24. So 100% of patients were able to get to a high score of 50, which is sort of similar to ASCR 50, is like 50% improvement. High score 75 was achieved in 30% of patients at week 4 and up to 95% by week 12, maintained to week 24. And the high score 90 was achieved at 20% at week 4 and 30% by week 12. They also had improvement in their DLQI and pain scores. They had one case of varicella zoster virus. 80% of patients had elevated creatinine kinase, but none of them had musculoskeletal symptoms or myoglobinuria. COVID vaccines were well tolerated. 4 out of 20 patients caught COVID but didn't have remarkable disease.
Cross your fingers for that one. I started one patient on this because nothing else has been helping. In episode 117, we learned that omega-3 supplementation can help with some of the side effects of isotretinoin. Pretty easy to do. Just take 1 milligram a day. We learned about COVID, and the people who have COVID are at an increased risk of getting an autoimmune disease in the next year or so. Not cool. We learned about a condition called transient abdominal telangiectasia of the newborn. If you have a newborn baby, possibly with some abdominal distension with like big telangiectasias covering most of their abdomen and what might look a little bit like a butterfly, good news, generally not dangerous, though if there are other concerning signs and symptoms, certainly consider something like an ultrasound. Why do we always use cyclosporin as a systemic calcineurin inhibitor in dermatology? Could we use tacrolimus instead? Well, take a listen and find out. It does have a little bit of data to support it, but it's just not as much data is probably the answer to that question. If you want to treat a patient with alopecia totalis / universalis and you don't feel like using a JAK inhibitor, perhaps because they're super expensive, consider methotrexate plus prednisone. It does seem to have similar efficacy to the new JAK inhibitors, at least in the trial that we discussed. Of course, there are more potential side effects with it, and getting people off of it can be challenging. And speaking again of JAK inhibitors and their use in all kinds of things, we had a case series of tofacitinib and how it was effective for bullous pemphigoid.
Very cool. In episode 118, we talked about nutraceuticals for hair and hair loss. This was a review of, they've originally looked at 6,000 plus articles. They found 11 articles that met their criteria. And looking at the interventions that might improve hair growth, they found potential benefit with Viviscal, Neurocrine, Nutrafol, Lamdapil, and Pantogar. They also found some benefit with isoflavone, omegas 3 and 6 with antioxidants, apple, nutraceutical, and total glycosides of peony and compounded glycoryzin tablets, but you have to be careful with the glycoryzin because that is a an inhibitor of the cytochrome P450 system. They also looked at zinc tocotrienol and pumpkin seed oil, which showed some benefit, as well as vitamin D3 and 45, which had low quality evidence for disease course improvements. Adverse effects were mild for all therapies. The Pantogar had, I think, one episode of pancreatitis associated with it. We talked about systemic allergic contact dermatitis to drugs, both topical drugs that might be absorbed through skin or mucosa, as well as systemic drugs, which are given by oral, parenteral, or rectal administration, can be responsible for systemic allergic contact dermatitis. The topical route is rare, with 41 culprit topical drugs found to cause systemic allergic contact dermatitis in 95 patients. Most reactions were caused by budesonide from inhalation, bufexemac, and dibucaine. Systemic allergic contact dermatitis from systemic drugs was infrequent. They found that the most frequently implicated drugs were mitomycin C, methylprednisolone, and hydrocortisone. So the largest group of culprit drugs was corticosteroids, which were responsible for more than 30% of reactions, and nearly 40% were not caused by therapeutic drugs, but by drug provocation tests. The most frequent manifestation of systemic allergic contact dermatitis from drugs were eczematous eruptions, which could be scattered, widespread, generalized, and they could also be maculopapular. The patients also, some of them had presentations with what we call SD-RIF, which is symmetrical drug-related intertriginous and flexural exanthema, previously referred to as baboon syndrome, or widespread erythema or erythroderma. Therapeutic drugs are rare causes of systemic allergic contact dermatitis. We don't 100% know why it occurs. The histology of alopecia areata and androgenetic alopecia was also looked at. And periobulbar infiltrates, of course, are what we would traditionally look for alopecia areata. Because, but as they say in the song, you can't always get what you want, but you usually get what you need. So you can sometimes also make an identification of alopecia areata from other features, including a catagen to telogen shift, melanin in fibrous tracts, which are kind of like pigment casts. Remember that alopecia areata and trichotillosis have overlapping histopathologic features. Small dystrophic follicles could also be seen in alopecia areata. Sometimes these are called nanogen follicles. And so these should be considered when you are looking at a specimen for trying to distinguish alopecia areata from patterned hair loss that doesn't have peribulbar infiltrates. We talked about isotretinoin ocular adverse effects and found that, of course, the most common side effect is dry eye, but other less common side effects, including vision change, can occur. And isotretinoin prescribers should monitor for ocular side effects. And we finally talked about psych meds in psychodermatology. And this was a systematic review. They were able to find some medications that were efficacious for primary psychodermatologic disorders, including trichotillosis, pathologic skin picking, nail biting, delusions of parasitosis, and dermatitis from compulsive hand washing. Sorry, I have a habit of knocking when I say that to try to not conjure it.
What are you trying to not conjure?
Delusions of parasitosis. Anyway,
okay.
So
don't make me say
it, don't make me say it a third time. That's how you conjure it. It's like Beetlejuice. So 7 different classes of medications were investigated, including SSRIs like fluoxetine, sertraline, and citalopram, tricyclic antidepressants, including clomipramine and disipramine, and antipsychotics, including olanzapine and pimazide, as well as anticonvulsants like lamotrigine and acetylcysteine, inositol, and milk thistle. And they were able to find support for the use of antidepressants in trichotillosis, specifically sertraline and clomipramine, fluoxetine in pathologic skin picking, and clomipramine and disipramine in pathologic nail biting and dermatitis from compulsive hand washing. They found antipsychotics could also be beneficial in trichotillosis, including olanzapine, and delusions of parasitosis, damn it, including pimazide, that was 3 times, and acetylcysteine in trichotillosis and skin picking. If my Monday morning clinic has a patient of challenge in it, I'm going to... No, I'm kidding. You've got episode 119.
My fault. Episode 119. As I mentioned, we discussed bimekizumab versus secukinumab for psoriasis. Bimekizumab was looking real good. We talked about the bizarre but effective use of selenium sulfide for hyperkeratosis. Who would have thought it worked? But it did in this case series.
I have a patient who has significant palmoplantar hyperkeratosis, and so we have her trying out. I'll have to report back when she comes back for follow-up.
We talked about maculopapular cutaneous mastocytosis in the pediatric population and whether or not they're more at risk of anaphylaxis and should receive EpiPens. I would say the data is still not 100% clear, so at least worth having a conversation with your families about that. We talked about the Meyerson phenomenon, where eczema can sort of show up around some benign lesion like a mole or, in this series, a dermatofibroma or two. And we learned about some of the manifestations of Langerhans cell histiocytosis in the head and neck world, so drainage from the ear or a lump on the scalp, for example. And today, we learned that avapritinib is a medicine that can be used for systemic mastocytosis, so get your patients to the oncologist. And we learned that IL-17 blockers are probably associated with a bit of an increased risk for inflammatory bowel disease, so screen your patients, but you can stop the medicine and hopefully they'll get better if it happens. Friends, thank you so much for hanging out with us today. And thanks, of course, for Steve Feldman. We also learned from him today about mental accounting. And if you would like to find all of our archive, including all of these episodes we just talked about, and more with Dr. Steve Feldman, you can find all of those on our website, dermospherepodcast.com. It's also a good way to reach out to us. You can also, of course, find us wherever you get your podcasts. One reason the website stays on and clipping along is because of the excellent members of Team Dermosphere. We've got a team of medical students who are really helping us out a lot. A lot of them are graduating this year. If there are any program directors out there listening, these guys are all dynamite, so please give their interviews and applications close consideration. They include Morgan Dykeman, Guy Kusecki, Eleonora Marcacci, Michael Birdsall, Angie Wong, Laura Dela Cruz, Jordan Easterling, Austin Callister, and Nicole Babkowski. Woo. They also help maintain our social media. You can find us on Twitter, or X, Instagram, and Facebook. It's the holiday season, guys. If you would like to give us a gift, you can donate to our podcast at uofuhealth.org/dermosphere. And you can also find more of our content in video format on YouTube and on ViewMedi. Thanks again, guys. And next time, I think, is going to be the 2023 Dermy Awards. So tune in for that and be on the lookout on our social media for an audience choice poll. We'll see you then.